This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're in for a special treat because we're taping this in Reason's DC headquarters in front of a live studio audience. And our guest is economist Russ Roberts, the John and Jean Denault Research Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, and the host of Econ Talk, an award-winning and immensely popular podcast built around hour-long conversations with academics, authors, and business leaders. Russ's most recent book is How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life, and previous titles include three allegorical novels about capitalism, individualism, and classical liberalism. Russ, thanks for joining the Reason Podcast.
It's great to be here, Nick.
So, Russ, in a recent episode of the podcast, and you interviewed National Review's Jonah Goldberg, who has a new book out called Suicide of the West. Other recent episodes have discussed the decline in labor force participation among men, the opioid crisis, and other disturbing trends in contemporary America. We live in a news cycle that is dominated by Sturm und Drang, anger, a sense of apocalyptic end-of-worldism. That I don't remember seeing since the 70s when it seemed like religious fundamentalists, gold bugs. Are there any gold bugs out there? Environmentalists and Cold Warriors all agreed we were one big sneeze away from just blowing the planet up. So my question to you first is, are you an optimist or a pessimist about our current moment and why?
Well, I think I'm going through my blue period right now. A lot of people liked my optimistic time when I was – this is before 2008. Things just seemed to be getting better and better every year, and I naively fell into a habit of thinking this was standard operating procedure. And events obviously got in the way of that, and my reading lately has gotten in the way of that. So I am in a somewhat darker mood than I usually have been. It's inflamed somewhat by the political climate, which is – you talked about the 70s. To me, it goes back to the 60s. That's when I think Americans didn't get along very well with each other. But that was when there was a war where tens of thousands of people were dying for something that a lot of people thought wasn't worth dying for. Here we have a very low unemployment rate. The economy's growing. And it seems like one sneeze away, you said, from marching in the streets. So what would it be like if we had, say, 15% unemployment? What if we have a trade war with China and the economy falls off the cliff? I can't imagine what's going to happen to the quality of our discourse. So I'm a little bit discouraged. I wouldn't say very discouraged. I think there are reasons to be optimistic, and there's also reasons to think that this is standard experience to be worried about the future, and it usually gets fixed, but I'm not so sure this time.
Well, what has happened since, say, whether you want to call it, peg it to the beginning in the 60s and culture clashes in the Vietnam War and the draft and the end of certain elements of kind of American culture, or the 70s or now? What's the motive force behind this kind of feeling that we have?
Part of it's the news cycle, obviously, that you referenced. I mean, part of it's just the dreariness of hearing that for the first time, I think probably in my lifetime, life expectancy isn't expanding every year. That's somewhat alarming. We seem to understand why. Which has something to do with opioids, perhaps, but we're not so sure why opioids are running rampant. There's a lot of pet answers for that, some of which might have some truth to them, but we don't really know.
And that you're talking about a decline in the life expectancy for white men, right?
That's turned out to be the focus of it. It was not right. It was. It might even be just be women. I'm not sure it was men or women, but it's one of the genders. But either way,
wait. You're not laying that one or two genders thing on us now, Russ. That's part of why it's a great time to be alive. There are as many genders as there are.
I think when the tape is reviewed, it will be clear that I left open a larger possibility than you're alluding to right now.
Why is life expectancy going down? Or do you have a pet theory? Is it kind of moral lassitude, or is it existential ennui? That's what is being trotted out.
So I think the challenge here is that it's really easy to tell yourself a story that is compelling to yourself, but which may not be true. So here's a story. Just a story. There's data for it, but it's just a story. The story is opioid use has skyrocketed the United States, painkillers, heroin, and that's because despair is growing. And of course, despair is part of the human condition. So you have to then ask yourself, is it despair really growing? Is it really imaginable that we have more despair now than we had, say, 50 years ago when life really was a lot worse for most people? Then you have to have a theory for why that is plausible, even though times were tougher then. So, but you can tell yourself a story that despair is growing. People have trouble finding work. Automation is – you can tell yourself a story. And some of it's true. Some of it is true. There are people in America having a very tough time and turn to ways to solve those wounds that are not healthy and can kill them. That's undeniably true. Is our body politic, our cultural life, is it sick, healthy? These are massively complicated things that it's really easy to convince yourself that there's something really horrible going on, say. And it could – the problem is that could still be true even though it's just a story you tell yourself. So I think the challenge is trying to – see past that and say, are there forces in motion that could make things better?
Well, let me ask you one of my theories then, assuming this is happening, or that despair is part of the reason why people are dying younger or are not looking for work and things like that. Is it perhaps that the United States is at the place now where, say, England was 50 or 60 years ago, where its moment on the world stage as a hegemon or as a major power was passing? And if you go back and you look at England before swinging London or anything like that, they were in despair. Their moment, you know, on the world stage was fading. And is that possibly happening to America? Because when we look at places like Asia and we look at places like South America and Africa, I got a feeling that they tell a different story.
Yeah, they're not so despairing. Yeah. Have you seen The Crown?
I try not to watch British exports. I'm doing my best. I don't buy American, but I try to watch American. I don't watch any shows. I'm anti-Shakespeare and I'm anti-English dramas.
I recommend Tom Stoppard. It's worth
yes,
it.
Yeah. Well, he's a Czech, really, so it's okay.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. So The Crown, which is tawdry soap opera, One Dimension, actually tries to grapple a little bit with this question of you were the most important nation in the world and now you're not much anymore. And if you go to talk to people from England, a lot of them are ashamed of their past now. They've gotten over the fact that they weren't important, and now they've realized that when they were important, they shouldn't have been enjoying it, right? And we have a little of that too. But I don't – even though I like that, that's a good story. I like the story. I don't think it explains why people in Ohio and rural West Virginia stay there and don't move to big cities and instead live off the state.
And you
or
don't
drugs.
Have you don't have a good answer for that.
No, I don't. No, I don't think anybody has a good answer, other than to make the observation that I recommend the book Dreamland by Sam Quinones. It's a phenomenal book where he explains that to a large extent the opium problem and the opioid problem in the United States is a technical innovation on the part of one small village in Mexico that figured out a way to get drugs, heroin in the United States for $5 crack. And that's pardon the pun. And that's part of the problem. It was a price change. Part of the problem was we subsidize pharmaceuticals in the United States, which I think is a lovely thought, but has some really unpleasant consequences. One of which is you can have a drug habit if you can find a doctor to write your prescription. There are a lot of them who do that. And then your out of pocket cost if you're on Medicaid is $5 for something that's worth on the street more than $1,000. That's a pleasant experience, unfortunately. So how much of it is that, those two things, versus an existential crisis? Hard to know. I don't think we have an existential – I mean, existential crisis is just, I think, to fill the papers. I don't think that's really the nature of what's going on in the United States.
Well, can I ask, is part of it – and I guess this is related to what I was saying – or never mind that. I was going to say it's related to what I said before, but – One of the recurring themes in your work, which I think is very interesting and very appealing to libertarians, is an emphasis on how little we actually know. There's a pretense to knowledge. I mean, you're a huge scholar and student of Hayek and a kind of you're furthering his ideas. And you've talked a lot about how, you know, we really know a lot less than we think, but we tell ourselves these stories and we puff ourselves up with confidence. And is it that in so many different areas, including economics, your chosen field of study, but in other areas of knowledge, we're you know, simultaneously we're innovating like crazy, but we're also coming to the end of our knowledge. I mean, it doesn't, economics seems to be explaining less than it did 20 or 30 years ago. Other forms of knowledge seem to be, we're not making sense of the world as well. So is it possible that, you know, part of the problem here is, you know, the very fact that you're saying, like, we just don't know that much, but we know we don't know that much.
I just want to emphasize, you did say I was a huge scholar. I'd like to know, clarify what you meant by that.
I'm not sure.
Okay, well.
A huge scholar.
I thought it was an appearance reference.
600 pounds.
I mean, that's what I was worried about.
The podcast audience can't see it.
Before this conversation started, Nick and I had a frank
exchange. We had to wheel him in a piano case, but you can't see that.
So it's a weird thing. I think a very narrow aspect of our knowledge is expanding like crazy, which is our technological engineering skills. We're extraordinarily good at that, especially in the United States. And we draw talent from all over the world to make things better, like the phone in your pocket, like your car, like the software that's going to drive the driverless car, and all the – and healthcare. There's some really glorious, wonderful things coming in the human experience. What we're not good at is understanding complex systems, and we have trouble accepting the reality that our knowledge of a small, specific technological problem does not carry over into our knowledge of society and complex systems. So what we do is, first of all, we can't face that, so we tend to be overconfident. We have a hubris problem. But the other thing is that we can't face it. We just can't accept the idea that our knowledge is imperfect. So in economics, we have people on both sides of so many issues saying we know X, where the other side saying we know Y, and X and Y are not mutually consistent. So, and they just merrily go along. It reminds me, there's a great Woody Allen short story about two people playing postal chess. I don't know if you know the story. I think it's from Without Feathers. So these two people are playing postal chess, and in halfway through the game, one of them says bishop to such and such a space, and he takes the other guy's piece, and the other guy says, I'm moving knight to such and such. And he says, oh, no, you can't be doing that because I took your knight four moves ago, so I assume you meant bishop to such and such. And they start – they're now on totally parallel tracks. The game ends with each of them checkmating each other. And that's the way I feel intellectual discourse is among many fields. Epidemiology and medicine has this problem. Economics certainly has this problem. Psychology has this problem. And overconfidence in empirical work, what we would call scientism, faux science, not real science. And people – you think about it. People going on TV, appearing on the front page of the New York Times, the Washington Post, because they know. And that's how you get attention. And if I had to say – we talked earlier about the – we alluded to a cultural malaise or despair. If you have to say something I'm really actually somewhat despairing about, or that I think is a cause for concern, it's our desperate need, which Adam Smith identified, that people pay attention to us. That's not new. That goes back to the Garden of Eden. It's really old, right? We like it when people pay attention to us, but we have some new vehicles for paying attention. And so it would be an interesting web page just to chronicle how many quotes on Twitter were not said by this or that famous person. And people just repeat them. Anger ensues. Attention ensues. So it's a big challenge, that piece for me. And that's related. I know I've gone way off track from what your question was. But I think the I'll say it a different way. And listeners have heard me say this many times, Econ Talk listeners. When I was growing up as an economist, there were only two famous economists, two and a half. There was Milton Friedman, Paul Samuelson, and you could say John Kenneth Galbraith. He was kind of in a different arena. But in the academic world, there were two economists who could get attention, Friedman and Samuelson. They had alternating columns in Newsweek every other week. That was narrow. That's two people. We now have this glorious world where hundreds and hundreds of economists can find a platform, be it on Twitter, be it on podcasts, be it on the web. That's the good news. The bad news is they're all fighting for attention. So the way you get attention is you exaggerate and you boast. You know, there was a paper in an Econ Talk episode I did with Luigi Zingales where he said that economists like to apply their reasoning to everyone except themselves, right? Which is human. We get that. We understand that. But economists believe people respond to incentives except for themselves. Economists believe that people are pushed to do things that are even subconsciously that are maybe not the right thing to do because the rewards are there. And I would suggest that we have a problem. And we're not the only field. There are many fields that have the same
Thankfully,
problem.
Journalism is completely exempt from that.
It's just objective in journalism. That's fantastic.
Can you, following up on that, can you quickly sketch your intellectual biography? How did your education, your upbringing, your affect how you think? And then if Wikipedia is correct, you're in your mid-60s?
I'm 63. I don't think that's mid-60s. Can we have a vote on that?
Yeah.
Early 60s
Wikipedia said you're 64, but so maybe they're off then.
Yeah,
or maybe they're right.
No,
I don't know.
Could be.
But in any case, okay, so you're 63.
Yeah.
Let's pretend, okay? Let's humor you. Has there been a big change in the way that you think about things? But how did you start to think this way, and why do you think this
way? So I started off as a, economics grad student eventually after undergrad, but eventually became an economic grad student at the University of Chicago, which is known for
its free football market.
Its football team, the Maroons.
Yeah. They used to be very good.
They used to be. In fact, they had the first Heisman Trophy winner, Jay Berwanger. And I attended, I think, one University of Chicago football game as a grad student. The stadium had been rebuilt, but it was the same stadium in the same location as where Fermi had split the atom for the first time. He did it famously in the squash courts underneath the stadium. So I'm sitting in the stands. This is all Nick's fault. And, of course, he can edit it out because it's his show. But
we're slowing this part down.
Yeah.
This is
the good
marrow.
Stuff. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting in the stands, and sitting behind me is – I'm pretty sure, who cares about this, but I think sitting behind me was the mayor of Chicago, which was Michael Blandick at the time. He was sitting next to, I think, Hannah Gray, who was the president of the university, and there was a third person behind them. And for some reason, I made some pleasant remark to Hannah Gray. I think I can't remember, but I said, "President Gray, nice to meet you. I'm Russ Roberts. I'm economics." And she said, well, she either probably introduced the mayor, and then she said, "And this is Jay Berwanger." And I said, I don't mean to hurt your feelings, Mr. Berwanger, but I'm probably the only person in these stands who knows who you are. And I think that was a true statement. He was very pleased that the number was one and not zero. But Chicago, I started off as a grad student at Chicago, which is a place that emphasizes free markets. In fact, when I went there, people told me that if you went there, you would become a free market ideologue. And of course, everyone who went there was already a free market ideologue. And the not literally, but a lot of us were. And the worry, people told me, was that we would be more Catholic than the Pope, meaning we would be more hardcore than the faculty even, which is probably true. But the religion at Chicago at the time was a skepticism about government regulation, a assumption that if there was a regulation proposed, you should measure its impact. There was a strong empirical bent that you should take a model, have testable implications, test them, and your knowledge would grow. And that's the way I was raised, literally, intellectually. So that's one side. The other side of me, I'd say, that's relevant is that I always loved reading fiction. So I spent most of my college years majoring in economics and reading as many novels as I could, and I always wanted to be a writer. And so my fictional economics is a comfort to me. I'm not a very good writer, but still, I feel like I'm in the game, right? It's fun. And so I've been lucky enough to marry the technical economics that I learned with some artistic narrative bent. That's what I would call it. Now, somewhere along the line, you asked me, what was that phrase? Did I change my mind?
I don't know.
What did I
learn? Who hurt you so badly that you are the way you are?
So somewhere along the line, really what happened is it's a fascinating psychological study for me, not for anybody else, but for me, having to host a podcast where I want to have on not just my friends. I don't want to just have on the people who agree with me. I want to have on people who don't agree with me. And if I do that, I have to be nice to them, more or less. If I'm a big enough platform, you can be rude to people who are mean to you because they'll come on anyway who you don't agree with. But if you're small, like Econ Talk, if you're not nice, no one's going to come on. So at some point, I realized I have to be civil, and I decided also I wanted to be civil, and then it forced me to actually imagine that I wasn't completely right all the time, which was a jarring thought.
Your wife is here, and I'm sure she's hearing this for the first time.
I know. No, it's alarming. It could have serious consequences. But to be serious, I was jarred by the fact that I had always believed that my side was right because we had the right studies and the other side had the bad studies and ours were the good ones. And theirs were silly and awful and badly done. And I think it was around the time when I interviewed Robert Frank, who looks at the world differently than I do. He's an interventionist and he's a lovely fellow. And I realized he looks at the world radically different than I do. And he goes to bed at night thinking he's right. And he's a nice person. And I like to think I'm a nice person. Why don't we agree? And the answer is because the truth is elusive. it's not straightforward. All my confidence about my side's studies and empirical work had to be challenged. And that was very it was dangerous because when I admitted that, people then would say, oh, so you have a bias. Yes, I said, I'm the only one. You know, Paul Krugman said I was ideological. And he was just a truth seeker. I said, you know, that's not nice. Don't laugh. That's not nice. And I'm sure, by the way, he sees himself as a truth seeker, as do most of economists who are in the public eye. But, my thought was his blog is called The Conscience of a Liberal. So that usually suggests an ideology. Now, I interviewed a macroeconomist, Ricardo Reich, at Columbia. And he mentioned something about ideology. And I said something, well, don't you worry that your ideology affects your science? He said, no, I keep them separate. He said, when I do my science, I take off my ideological hat. And I said something like, or at least thought, maybe I said it, I don't remember, that hat's really hard to take off. And that's when I started to think a lot about that. And that, you know, that ties together for me the Hayekian point you mentioned earlier about the limits of our reason, limits of our knowledge. And then I was sort of unmoored, right? Because if I'd convinced myself all this time that I had the right studies and the bad guys had the bad studies, well, now did I have to become an agnostic? And the answer was no. I found a way to save my classical liberalism, my libertarianism. How? By going to my principles. I said, my principles I think are true, but in any one case, the attempt to prove it through some scientific method is probably not so true. One of my favorite moments as a host, I interviewed Milton Friedman in August of 2006, shortly before he passed away, and he said something like, the principles you and I agree on will last for 10,000 years. And I thought, well, that's something you can hold on to, although I wasn't in my crisis yet, but I look back on it. But I'd say the biggest thing I've learned is that the certainty of my economics worldview, which at Chicago is extremely certain. We've got rational people making rational decisions, and the market transforms those decisions into these very predictable outcomes. I lost faith in that a pretty long time ago, meaning in the last 10 years. And that was also hard to give up. It's related to the whole story. But those are the ways I think I've changed, and I think I'm the better for it. So I hope. I can ask my wife later.
You mentioned libertarians. Briefly, what are the basic principles for libertarians, that you hold on to,
so,
in spite of them being disproven by everything that we encounter in the world?
Yeah. I'm going to broaden it a little bit if I could, sort of the general principles. I think, people respond to incentives. These are, I would say, are my economics philosophical principles that lead to a free market approach or classical liberal libertarian approach. So people respond to incentives. The world's a complicated place. People care a lot about what other people think of them, which is my Adam Smith side. My knowledge is imperfect. Liberty. So here's a big one. I'm going to challenge you, Nick. And I hate this, by the way, when guests do this to me. It's like,
I'm not paying attention.
Ask the questions. You answer them, okay? And I've already lost my train of thought. See, before
Liberty.
My show, I edit this part out. Liberty. So I like believing that people yearn to be free. And when I think about that, this is still answering your question, that people yearn to flourish. They yearn to express themselves. They yearn to take their gifts and use them in the world in the service of others. Making money along the way, of course, but the only way to easily make money is to use your gifts in the service of others. And that's my romance that remains about free markets and libertarianism, which is it is a the complexity of the world means that we need a way to organize our creativity from the bottom up and not the top down. And we all yearn to do that. And that's why the guards face south in Cuba and in Mexico. They don't face north. People aren't trying to break into Cuba. You hear all these people talking about how great Cuba is or some other country, and yet people risk their lives to come to this inequality-ridden, despair-ridden place called the United States, which still has a modicum of freedom. And so that's what I hold on to, I think, more than anything else for my optimism, to come back to your even earlier point. And yet I do worry, as some suggest, that we also like to be told what to do. We also like to put our head down. We also like to look up to a great leader who will inspire us and give our lives meaning, when in fact we have to give our own lives meaning by our own actions and our own beliefs. And so, but we have this thing inside us, I think, to turn to the politician, the celebrity. And so I worry more about those things than I used to.
So, and this will be the final question, then we'll open it up to the audience. How big a role should politics play in a good libertarian's life? Or how much mind share and bandwidth should we be giving to politics? And what do you do in a world where it's the choices literally between Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, Elizabeth Warren or Jeff Sessions? We can go on and on with an antimony of kind of horror, really.
Yeah.
So what do you do? Because do you just ignore it or do you attack it? But then how do you not ruin your entire life by spending all of your time talking about politics rather than getting on with what I think most of us in this room would agree is the real stuff of life?
Yeah. So I used to believe, part of my naive University of Chicago economics methodology, I used to believe it didn't matter who was elected president, that political and economic forces would drive that person to do the same thing. I remember a former student of mine who works at the CIA said, when Barack Obama gets elected and they give him the briefing, he's going to act just like his predecessor. And there's some truth to that, right? So there's a lot of truth to that. It's like once you get your hand on the toys, you want to use them. It's not and I don't think it has anything to do with who's in office particularly or their party. So there is still a certain truth about that political outcomes are driven by large forces, and yet starting to think maybe push that theory a little too far. And we're in a time now where who is the next president really matters. And I have a feeling, and I we're taping this, it'll be preserved, but even though I don't want to choose between Joe Biden and Mitt Romney, there would be something comforting about that in the next election, because the alternative is going to be my version of the alternative would be Oprah against Ronda Rousey. And I don't know who I'd vote for there either. So your question, though, is how should we think about this? And I've spent probably like you most of my life thinking that politics is a corrosive activity on the human soul. It is a ugly blood sport that demeans human beings, and that sounds terrible, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is, and we're recording this on a Monday. This is going to be a hell of a week, I got to tell you.
But I have to say, I really, as opposed to the other view, which I get my listeners really get mad at me when I suggest that government isn't something we do together, because I don't think it is, and so I don't get romantic about government. I don't get romantic about politics. I'm not an anarchist though, so I'm okay with political outcomes. It's a reality, we have to deal with them. And as there are probably many of these people in this room who don't vote as a matter of principle, I do vote as a matter of principle. I think it's important. At the same time, I don't think it's where I want to spend my – I don't want it in my head, my attic, my intellectual mental attic. I want it out in the shed in the back. I don't want it messing around with my – so I don't know about you guys out there, but I spend a lot less time following the news than I used to, because I find it – one, I find it deeply depressing. Like, I don't know who a lot of the characters are. The way I figure out whether they're good or bad is I see who in my Twitter feed gets excited when one of them gets, arrested or not. And then I was, oh, that was a bad guy. And then I realize I don't even know if there's any way to find out if that is a bad guy. So and then I also think back to way the past scandals of our time, right? We have the Clinton scandals. I'm old enough because I'm in my mid to late 60s. I'm old enough to remember Watergate, which I remember the day that Nixon resigned. I was on my way to the racetrack for my summer job, and I thought, it was a beautiful day. I took a deep breath and I thought, is the world better now or worse? Have we been saved? I don't know. But people acted like there'd been a godly event, a divine, inspirational thing. And we're at that same place now, a different president. And we'll be that way with his successor. And so my view is, my first thought is stay away from it. It's poison. Our daughter, when she was young, was an intense person, and a friend of ours in the neighborhood said, you know, I think she's going to be an activist. And I thought, God forbid. I don't want an activist, right? Activists do bad things to make the world a better place in their warped personal view. So there's a natural tension between passivism, stoicism, and saying, this whole thing's a circus, I'm not going to dirty my hands, versus maybe the country's drifting into something really horrible and I need to stand up. So right now I'm still in the passive phase. We'll see.
Well, when you start collecting Social Security and Medicare, right?
Any day
then
now.
You're going to be like,
well,
God
the
damn
big
it.
Thing, you know what I found out? The big thing is when you turn 62, two big things happen. You get the discount for the National Parks Pass, and you get the ArcLight discount, which means you can see a movie for $2 less than the other people around you. It's phenomenal.
Well, let's give a big hand to Russ Roberts. And now let's open it up to the audience. You're the real stars. Does somebody have a question for Russ Roberts? Yes, please stand up and stand up. Okay, now sit down. No, stand up.
Fight.
Introduce yourself and please ask away.
Matthew Feeney from Cato Institute, former reasoner. Who's the novelist who writes about economics the best?
And I'll just say that real quick again. That was Matt Feeney of the Cato Institute, late of reason, who asked Russ Roberts, who is the novelist who writes the best about economics?
You know, that's it. I'm going to two different ways to interpret that question. So I'm a big fan of Charles Dickens, who's I don't like his economics generally, but I like his writing. And he does write about economics. So he's one of the best writers about economics. But in terms of who's, I don't know. Who's writing fiction that has good economics? Not too many. It's pretty rare, right? Economics does not attract a lot of you think about it. You have Tom Wolfe, right? A Man in Full. There's a little bit of economics that runs through that. Give me some other choices. I'm trying to think of who. Neal Stephenson is a brilliantly creative writer and I think a tremendous stylist. He's right. He wrote some interesting things about technology that have economic aspects to them. Anybody else out there? I'd take some suggestions. I'd be happy to comment on them.
I am having a senior moment myself, and I have to. Who's the French novelist? He's the the French Dickens, author of Père Goriot.
Balzac.
Balzac.
I haven't read any Balzac.
Oh, you should.
But I've heard of him.
Yeah. Well, what you would love, I think, about him is that his novels. He's writing around the same time as Dickens, and it's very much about the rise of the industrialized nation, the city, and the possibilities and the scandals that ensue from that kind of anonymity and rapid change in status.
And people have encouraged me to do an Econ Talk episode on Anthony Trollope and his writings on financial crises. I'm a big Trollope fan, although I remember them mainly for the romance. I wasn't so interested in the economics at the time. Any other suggestions of people, modern writers maybe who are writing about economics that we could talk about?
Robert Heinlein.
Yeah, I when I was younger, I read some Heinlein. I read, of course, Ayn Rand, who's I would say is the most famous economic. There's a few others. What?
Michael Lewis
doesn't write fiction, but certainly writes on economics.
Ray Bradbury.
I'm a big Ray Bradbury fan. But what?
David Foster Wallace on the IRS.
I have not read that, but I'm a big fan of I'm not a big fan of modern fiction or I would say more avant-garde fiction like David Foster Wallace, but I really am a big fan of his quote from his commencement address where he says everyone worships, and I think that's another insight into our time that we all have things that we hold sacred. For some, it's our sports teams. Go figure. Nick doesn't like the Celtics. He's confessed earlier.
Yeah. Confessed.
I do. He wouldn't come into my church, the TD Garden, you know. And we have sports. We have ideology. We have our political parties. And we have the old-time religion. And as people move away from religion, they find other things to worship. And some of those are irrelevant in terms for the body politic, and others are very powerful. So we're off the subject. I've totally forgot.
Let's
nothing else to say.
Go to another question. Catherine Mangu Ward of Reason.
Since you very modestly didn't talk about your own book just then, I'm going to make you do that. I got The Invisible Heart for my wedding as a gift.
Whoa.
Was that on your registry?
It was.
It was like right next to a gravy boat. Yeah.
I was just interested to hear you say basically that the fiction writing sort of welled up from your heart and then you combined it with economics, because I would have maybe pegged it more as a delightful propaganda vessel.
So Catherine Mangu Ward of Reason asks about The Invisible Heart, which that was your first novel,
second.
Right? Or second, okay. Where did that come from? Was that not just a propaganda tool?
No, so that you left out the part that she got as a wedding present, which I cherish that now. So it's an interesting aspect of human cognition for me, and it's something I've become very interested in, which is how we absorb knowledge and information, right? So I have hundreds of hours of conversation on Econ Talk, which is – and you have a podcast. And it's clear to me that conversation is one way we learn things, which – is at least a plausible hypothesis, given that for most of human history, we only had conversation. We didn't have any other technology. That was the way we communicated. The other way we communicated is we told stories. So the reason I got into fiction is that in the late 80s, somewhere in the middle of the time when Americans were very worried about Japan destroying American jobs, Frontline had a documentary where they described how we were getting our lunch eaten by Nintendo. We should run these again, these documentaries, that Nintendo is keeping all the good jobs in Japan and giving the customer service jobs to Americans to answer with poor, mediocre wages. And then they showed a scene from the first Gulf War, soldiers returning and marching, and they said, "We won that war. How come we can't win the economic war?" And I got goosebumps when I saw that, even though I hated the argument. I get goosebumps telling you the story now. That phrase is powerful. And I thought, we need to tell the story of free trade with the same emotional impact that people use to criticize free trade. And so I decided I was going to make a movie. And I called Milton Friedman, and I said he had done Free to Choose. And I asked him how he'd done that. And he said, you should call Bob Chittister, who's a great producer. And I went to see Bob, and we decided we're going to make a movie. Then I realized it's really weird to write a book about trade, which is at the heart of usually an idea called comparative advantage, where I had no comparative advantage of any kind of advantage in raising money or making a movie. But I knew how to write a little bit, so I said, you know, forget this movie idea. I'm going to write a book. So I wrote a novel, a didactic – I like that allegorical phrase you used – an allegorical didactic fable about trade. And then I realized it was fun, and I decided to do another one. And that was The Invisible Heart, which was basically I think of it as a philosophical manifesto. And then my third book was The Price of Everything, which is a attempt to tell via fiction the ideas of complexity and emergent order, which I think are the deepest things that economics and economists understand. So what I'm really trying to do in all those books is, one, teach people things they don't know about, but second, move the heart. And I think our side, the side that believes in freedom, is losing the battle for hearts. We've been really good at reason. We're really good at the mind. And we need to be better at hearts. We need more folk songs. You know, that's why I made the rap videos I did. We need things that amuse and delight and are memorable and that touch people's souls, because that's what moves people. There are a few people, and most of us are in this room, where reason is paramount. But for most other people, and this is a small room, unfortunately, but for most people, they want to be part of something larger than themselves, ideally with other people, and they want to feel inspired, and they want to feel they're making the world a better place. And I think that's what our side needs to do more of, and I think fiction is one way to do that. We need more movies. We need more fiction. We need more songs. We need more cartoons. We need more everything.
experimental.
And more recent magazine and more
experimental
recent
dance.
Dance, definitely. Okay. Definitely yeah. dance.
All right. We were talking about concrete poetry earlier today in the office. We need more concrete poetry,
absolutely.
Like in a dollar sign.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, arrange it. Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Other questions? Yes.
Can I ask a double barrel question?
Sure, but you got to shoot both barrels.
Is that allowed in D.C.?
Yes.
The first question is, how would you grade Trump on his economic policy so far? And the second is, do you believe, even with all of your stoicism and being removed from politics, that bad economic policy can ruin a nation, at least for the term of a presidency?
So, and let me just, to make sure we got that all on the tape, that was
Ricky
Ratliff with CRTV asking, how would you grade Trump on his economic policy so far? And can a bad economic policy really hurt a nation, at least for the term of a presidency?
So the first part is classroom participation's been excellent. Twitter feed's really active. It's very good. So I think there are two big things. I'd say three big things, and I'll probably think of a fourth. But the three big things are an adjustment in the tax system, the tax code, which was accompanied by a cut in rates by income taxpayers, an expansion of government spending, and a potential trade war with China. So I'll try to go quickly through all three of those things. I think cutting taxes is a really good idea unless you don't cut spending. It's even worse if you raise spending when you're cutting taxes, because all you're doing is increasing future taxes. So we didn't really cut taxes. We raised future taxes by the combination of spending more and lowering the rates. Lowering the amount that corporations pay is probably a good idea. Most economists on the left, if they were in a small room and not on being recorded, would admit as much. It's better to tax human beings than it is to tax entities. It's better to tax consumption at the final level than to tax productivity and other things that help workers. So I think that was a good idea by itself. Unfortunately, it had two problems. One, that we spent more at the same time, which was problematic. And secondly, only a small proportion, it's so depressing, a small proportion of the American workers pay income tax. So,
Wait, why is payroll tax? Yeah, explain why that's a problem.
Why that's a problem? Well, two reasons. Number one is, so what I would have preferred is if you'd cut taxes across the board, income and payroll taxes, and cut spending at the same time. And I think that would have been wonderful for the economy and human beings, but didn't do that. He cut his base, his taxes, which is mostly the richer Americans, and he left the working Americans who pay payroll taxes but who don't pay much federal or none, got nothing. So why is it important? There's two reasons it's important. One is we're under the illusion, most people are, you aren't in this room, I'm sure, but many people are under the illusion that their payroll taxes go and are put aside for their Social Security benefits later in life. This is not true. They go into the government's coffers where they're spent for everything right now, including the war in Afghanistan and food stamps, SNAP, and other things. And so there's an illusion there that people who are paying payroll taxes don't realize that they're financing government and not their own well-being. So that's number one. Number two, again, I just would have liked to see that stimulus, and that's a bad word. I didn't mean stimulus, because that has the wrong ring to it. The change in incentives for people to have lower tax rates to go toward all Americans and not just people who happen to pay federal income tax. But most importantly, if you pay zero income tax, or at least if you perceive you do because either you do or the only tax you pay is a payroll tax that you think is going toward yourself, then a dollar of government spending is a dollar that's free to you, which means that the political demand for spending is very high. That's the first problem, right? You have a large portion of the American people who think the government spending costs them nothing. The second thing that's bad is that a huge portion of government spending is being financed by a very small portion of the electorate, which are the richest Americans, who then have – this is so bizarre. We don't like to think about it, but it's true. It's in the politicians' interest to make sure they thrive, because they're the cash cow that funds their activities, which means that we protect Wall Street. We protect the pharmaceutical industry. We create a very bad set of unvirtuous feedback loops to make sure that rich people can still help finance the government cow. And that's just disastrous. So the incentives of that were extremely unhealthy. So that was the first third, right? The tax cut and the spending. Well, that was one thing. The second thing we said he did was – Oh, no, the spending. So that's the first. That's two-thirds. The third part's the tariffs. Now, here's the interesting thing about the tariffs. It's true. It is certainly true that China doesn't play fairly in the economic game of international trade, but not because they run a trade. We run a trade deficit with them. That is not a result of unfairness. That's a result of the fact that we, in general, import more stuff from the rest of the world than they import from us. And at the same time, they invest more in the United States than we invest in their countries. That's a mixed bag. It's a good thing because we're a very good place to invest. So people want to invest here. We're a better place to invest for most people than other places, which means we're going to run a surplus of investment, a capital account surplus. What that means is we have more money to spend on goods and services. So we run a trade deficit, meaning we import more from the rest of the world than they import from us. That's really pretty pleasant, unless you're borrowing a lot of money at the governmental level and you're going to have to pay it back and it all feeds through that. Put that to the side for the moment. My point is that the trade deficit with China is not evidence that they're cheating or they're unfair or anything like that. And so that part of the Trump story about the deficit, about the tariffs, is misleading, xenophobic, encourages them to put tariffs on our stuff. It's horrible. There is a nugget of truth, which is in his move, though, which is they don't evidently have much respect for our intellectual property. Okay, fine. Then the question is putting tariffs on steel and aluminum and other things likely to get them to be more honest about how they treat intellectual property? The answer is I doubt it. So he fails on both counts there, both on the intellectual case he makes for it, which I think is misleading and dishonest, and secondly, on the likelihood it'll succeed. But if it does succeed, if he's able to change the rules of the game in how we trade with China and they trade with us, not that it'll be more fair, but in the, oh, we import more than they do from us, that'll change. No, that the stuff they import from us, they pay the right price for, and they don't use their domestic investment as a way to encourage American companies to give them insights and property that American companies have developed, then that might be a good thing. And I will take off my hat to him, and I will say he's done a good thing. One of the worst things I think about our political climate right now is if you say anything nice about Trump, like I just said something nice, right? A little bit nice. I said, if that works out well, I'll have to concede that he was onto something. And then I have to put a comma and say, but of course he's a horrible person. So you don't think I'm a bad person for saying something nice about him. Now, I think he is a horrible person, right? I have a friend who said he's great for parenting. You just point to him and you say to your kid, see everything he does? Don't do that.
Yeah, but that's a mixed message because he's the president of the United States.
Doesn't excite me. Doesn't excite you
but
either.
But I mean, to your kid, you know, this is – let's have time for one more question in the back there. Go ahead. Who are you?
Hi, I'm Ryan Carrada. Earlier you mentioned something about how you said economists think about incentives for everyone else but don't apply those incentives to themselves. And you said there's a glut in economic thinking. What in your mind can fix the economics profession?
Okay, so the question was that economists apply incentives to everyone but themselves, and there's a glut of economic thinking. How do we clean up that mess?
Well, it's obvious. We need licensing. I know I've got a great crowd when you know when I'm joking. I appreciate that. There was a recent discussion among elite economists of whether too many people who weren't trained as economists were allowed to be economists. And of course, most economists said they shouldn't be because we need certification of some kind. And a graduate degree is so the answer, of course, is that there's no easy way to fix that. I used to think we would create – this is great. So I don't know if any of you heard this episode. We had a recent episode of Econ Talk with Vincent Rajkumar, who's multiple myeloma expert from the Mayo Clinic. He was talking about how expensive cancer drugs are and how doctors have an incentive to prescribe drugs because they often are administering them and they make a profit on them by doing so. And it's very hard for a doctor. It's an unbelievable moment to me, actually, where a doctor admitted that someone, talking about criticizing your own profession, that they responded to those incentives and might do something subconsciously, but do something that was harmful to their patients, which goes against their code, their ethics, and so on. And so I think that's a really extraordinary thing. And so I used to think that shame would help, that the doctors could be shamed into being respectful of those incentives and aware of them, that economists could be shamed to be aware. And he has, I think that's called snickering from Nick. And I think I understand that. But I do think shame matters, by the way, and I do think there is some role for it to play, but it is limited. It is limited. But I do think that's the, by far, even though that's a trivial, not trivial, but unlikely to transform the profession, calling out the emperor has no clothes over and over again eventually may cause the emperor to go put a robe on. And so I think that's true in economics. I think it's true in medicine. It's even true in journalism, by the way, where I used to tell journalists, I used to run programs for journalists, and I would suggest to them that they were biased. That made them so angry, right? To me, it was so obvious that they were biased, right? Because I'm on the outside. But they could not accept that about themselves because their whole ethos, their credo is objective reporting. And for better or for worse, I think the current intellectual environment, you made a joke about journalism earlier, has forced journalists to be a lot more biased and a lot more comfortable admitting whose side they're on than they used to be. And I like that. I like the honesty of that. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, so. Isn't that, I mean, in the end, that because that's the beginning of knowledge, right?
Yes.
Where you're recognizing what you're stuck on.
Yeah.
And things like that.
Yeah.
And this is one of the reasons why I'm optimistic. For some of the reasons that you're pessimistic, I feel like people are more aware of their situation or what they're coming out of. We have a lot more meta conversations about epistemology and things like that.
Yeah, a lot of, like, around the water coolers of America, there's a lot of epistemological conversations. Are you serious, Nick? Are you going to push that?
You know, I was going to say, like, you're talking, well, like, nobody uses water coolers anymore anyway. So it's like, you know, you're bringing
Touché.
In your own bottle.
Touché,
but,
yeah.
No, but I think we're in a kind of meta conversation where TV is about watching TV. We're much more self-critical than we used to be, I would like to believe.
And I think in some extent, just to extend that, I think that's an excellent point. I think people are more aware.
You can just say I'm wrong. You don't have to patronize me with the but combination dad, professor. That's a really interesting point. All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. We have been talking with Russ Roberts of the Hoover Institution and the longtime host of Econ Talk, just a wonderful podcast. Everybody should subscribe to that. What's the best way to subscribe to Econ Talk, Russ Roberts?
So you can go to iTunes, your friendly app on your phone, your podcast app on
your
phone.
So this is a corporate podcast then? You're using Apple? Like you're not going to... There isn't an artisanal RSS feed we can go to? Or
That's an interesting question. I think there is, but I'm not an artisanal... I keep my the only artisanal side of me is really bread, you know, from my wife's hands. But we're also on SoundCloud. We're on Stitcher. We're in
you're
a
all
lot,
over the place. If
all,
people Google Econ Talk, one word,
yes,
and Russ Roberts,
they'll find it. Yeah.
And do you want them to subscribe?
It's not a trick question. It makes me feel loved. So. You know, my Adam Smith side says, sure, I have to confess, I do like it when people listen.
Well, you know...
I wish I was above that, Nick, but
no,
I'm not.
No, you know, and I'll say this, it certainly has been a model that I think a lot of us share at Reason of an in-depth conversation that is civil, but is also informed, and you don't roll over for people, but you do have a conversation, which is, you know, we could always use more of that, I think, so... So we have been talking with Russ Roberts of the Hoover Institution and Econ Talk. Russ, thanks so much for talking.
Great being here.
This has great. And this has been the Reason Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for coming.